back at WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. I've let my hair down for this segment. We're going to be letting our hair down with the Maryland Lottery. We're going to be doing our Maryland Crab Cake Tour with Mayor Brandon Scott on Wednesday, and also Senator Corey McCray is going to be joining us. We're going to have some Coppin representatives, and the great Mike Resigliano, sports cartoonist, will be having a crab cake with us on Wednesday on our Crab Cake Tour. Next week, Black Friday, we'll be up in Abingdon with our friends at Conrad's Crabs, and then on to Pappas on December the 3rd. It's been a very eventful year, I think a year with masks on. We all sort of came out and came together in various ways, and about 2 months ago, my very first job that sort of launched all of this was at the Baltimore News American as a sports intern. I then went on to the Evening Sun, spent a little time there, about 5 minutes at the Sun after the merger happened, and then out the door in 30 years. It'll be 30 years on December the 13th that I started doing this crazy radio thing. This guy's name came up to me in various ways through the National Enquirer. He left Baltimore when we were colleagues at the News American. I was 15 years old to go to the Philadelphia Daily News, where he covered some very interesting Philadelphia Eagles teams with Buddy Ryan. And then I saw him chasing John Denver up a mountain on some television show, and that's more than 30 years ago. And the next time I saw his name was in like the last 4 years with David Pecker and Donald Trump, and I'm like, I know Barry Levine. And then all of a sudden we wind up at this incredible reunion of Baltimore sports writers at the Guinness Factory back in September. And Barry said, I've got a book. I'm going to come on. We're going to talk about all this the new media stuff that's happening around Departed Soul and Jeffrey Epstein. Barry Levine, I have no idea where life has taken you the last 35 years, but it has been a pleasure to have you on my radar. How are you?
Thank you, Nestor. It was fantastic to see you a little while back at the sports reunion in Baltimore, to see all those aging sports writers and production people from our youth, I would say. I mean, that was back in the early 80s. You were practically still in diapers.
I was 15 years old, and I know I told you the story about Bernie Miklas's goodbye party up on Chase Street in a little apartment where it was like the movie Sea of Love, where that song would drop on the turntable, but it was the Nancy Sinatra song, These Boots Are Made for Walking. And all of our compadres, I mean, Ken Davis went to Connecticut, Bernie Miklas, Jeff Gordon went to St. Louis and worked at the Post-Dispatch. John Hawkins went on to a very, very incredible career being a golf writer for many, many years. So lots of people went lots of directions. Can I just ask you, and what happened to you, dude? Where did you go? Because I'm like talking about John Denver up a mountain and you're laughing a little bit, but I'm not wrong, am I?
No. Listen, I enjoyed my years in sports and particularly love the 5 years I spent at the Baltimore News American, where I was actually the first reporter at the Colts complex in Owing Mills, Maryland, the morning after the move.
Wow.
And it was probably the most exciting story I ever did, because we were, still an afternoon paper in those days. Again, this is in before the internet, and nobody knew for sure what happened to the Colts in the snowstorm the night before. There were rumors that Robert Irsay had, in fact, moved them to Indianapolis, but nobody confirmed the story. And I got a call from the Baltimore news desk at the crack of dawn saying, will you go up to the Colts complex and see if you can confirm the move? And I did. Maybe it was the first thing I ever did en route to a career in celebrity tabloids for a number of decades. But I show up at the Colts complex that morning, and the state police were turning away media, and I had to make a snap decision on you know, if I said I'm press from the News American, they're not going to let me in. So I think I told a little white lie by dropping the name of one of the assistant trainers from the Colts, and they shooed me through, and I ended up in the training complex, and I see Frank Cush, who was the coach of the Colts, and he said, "Barry, what are you doing here? There's not supposed to be any media. We're here packing up the remainder of the stuff." He said, "Last night they moved everything in the Mayflower moving vans, including Johnny Unitas's cleats, to Indy, where there's going to be a press conference later today." And I said, "Well, Frank," I said, "I got to get a confirmation from you to make our addition." And he said, "You know," he said, "I'll probably get in a ton of trouble." But he said, the fact is, this is despicable. It's one of the worst days in, you know, Baltimore Colts history that this franchise went out the door for money. And I'm writing everything down. I said, thank you. And I go to the payphone. This, of course, before cell phones. And one of Irsay's guys threw me out and said, he's a press guy. Get him the heck out of here. And he threw me out into the field. There was a big chain link fence, and I was on the side of the training field, and it had snowed the night before. So I had to literally hike up through snow up to the main road to get to a gas station, to get to a payphone. And I made the only call that all reporters ever dream of making, which is like, you know, stop the presses. I've got the exclusive. And I called the news desk and I said, I got confirmation that the Colts have moved. Frank Cush, the owner or the coach of the team, has confirmed it and so forth. So we splashed the cover of the afternoon edition of the News American saying Colts coach confirms move to Indy. And later that afternoon, I have a photo somewhere. It shows the mayor of Indianapolis holding up a special edition of the Indianapolis Star newspaper that has my story bannered on the front page saying Colts coach confirms move to Indy. And that was a very exciting moment, terrible moment for the city of Baltimore. And but, you know, I was able to get the goods. And I have to tell you, Nestor, frankly, the job at the News American those 5 years was so much fun in terms of covering boxing and football.
Well, why did you come? I mean, I didn't know you well, and I only knew you for a very short period of time because the paper was falling apart from the minute I got. That's why I got there. It's why a 15-year-old kid was covering skipjack games for $3.33 an hour under the table from the Hearst Corporation. But you were in my life for maybe 8, 9, 10 months and then gone. Everybody was looking for a job because they knew the paper was going out of business.
It was. To be a writer, to work for an afternoon paper where the paper gave you the opportunity to really experiment with your writing and tell stories and give you the space to tell those stories. That was something that was fantastic for someone like myself who wanted to be a writer. And the News American went the way of all afternoon papers. They all disappeared. I went to Philadelphia. Covered the Philadelphia Eagles for a season. It was actually Buddy Ryan's first season as coach of the Eagles. And he was a great quote in terms of everything he said. And that was a lot of fun. And then I actually had an offer out of left field. It was an opportunity to move to Los Angeles to work for a tabloid newspaper that the Murdoch Corporation had put out called the Star Magazine. And it just was, I viewed it as what my roots were in terms of loving journalism. And that was the kind of the fedora wearing, you know, stop the presses, the press card in your fedora mentality of going out and doing fun stories and things like that, going on adventures. And I took that job and moved out to Hollywood, and I had a ball for the next you know, 25 years.
So you were in LA the whole time. I didn't know.
No, I was in LA for 5 years, and then I was recruited to come to New York to work for Current Affair TV, which was a daily tabloid TV show, as the managing editor. And these were in the days of O.J. Simpson, Amy Fisher, the Long Island Lolita, the Susan Smith case. And it was a crazy time in television, in terms of television news. And I ate it up and continued on. As Press Clips will show, I ran a Pulitzer Prize nominated team in terms of breaking an exclusive. We also broke through the whole Tiger Woods thing. And I had my fill of all that. I wanted to do my own thing. And a couple of years ago, I moved into writing my own, authoring my own books. I wrote a book on Donald Trump called All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. I was very proud of that book in terms of what it revealed. And out of that book came, in terms of the reporting that I did, particularly down in Florida, came his association with Jeffrey Epstein. And Trump, of course, was a friend of Epstein's. They socialized together.
Well, there's that famous video of them dancing as they enter the room. I think Tom McMillan got swept up in that video from 20 or 30 years ago as well. And you know, this isn't a secret that they kept company and kept company of underage women. And, you know, like and Epstein was dead in a cell, and how it all happened. It's right up there with the Zagruder tapes. Right. I mean,
I found the story. I was just finishing the editing on the Trump book when Jeffrey Epstein word came that Jeffrey Epstein had died here in New York in his jail cell, and that gave me even more of a spark to go out and tell the whole story of not only Jeffrey Epstein, but I thought, as interesting as this incredible diabolical predator who go down in the annals of true crime in America, that his association with this woman, Ghislaine Maxwell, this Oxford educated British socialite from London, who became, I mean, I refer to them in my book as the predatory Bonnie and Clyde, because she came into his life. And as I've reported in my book, through interviews with more than 100 people, including associates and victims and survivors of the story, it is impossible to think that the depth of Jeffrey Epstein's predatory behavior could have taken place without the assistance of this woman, Ghislaine Maxwell. Now,
she's been in the news a lot, but haven't heard much lately, right?
Well, what's happening with Ghislaine is that a year after Jeffrey Epstein's death, she was arrested by the feds, and her trial is beginning later this month here in New York in Brooklyn. She faces 80 years behind bars for a period of time of grooming and sexual abuse of his underage victims. And the period of time that the feds are focusing on is 1994 to 2004. And it was in that period of time that she was living with Epstein in New York and Palm Beach, in the Virgin Islands at his mansion there, New Mexico, and so forth, where she really was in charge of the operation, which was overseeing this sex trafficking ring involving young girls.
Where did all of his money come from, Epstein's money, to have all of this? And as far as your research, when did this turn into having enough money to be able to have Fantasy Island?
Right. Well, Epstein back in the 80s, as I report in my book, The Spider, Inside the Criminal Web of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, I report that Epstein made initially some money on Wall Street, but he went rogue and he embedded himself with some very, very wealthy international arms dealers at the time. Guys like Adnan Khashoggi, another guy in England that Epstein served as kind of a middleman in these deals and siphoned off millions and millions of dollars, I believe illegally. And he gained a reputation at that time of kind of, I will say this about Jeffrey, he was a brainiac. He was a mastermind. His head worked like a computer. He could, he didn't need calculators or adding machines. He was able to find ways to make very wealthy people even richer by avoiding certain tax shelters and things like that. And he was a master manipulator in allowing them to make even more money. And through the process, he became extremely wealthy. He took on one benefactor, a man named Leslie Wexner, who was the head of the Limited Company. That is the parent company to Victoria's Secret. And for a period of time, Wexner was Epstein's main client. Epstein became his money manager. He became very, very close to him. While Leslie Wexner denies any part of wrongdoing, he does admit that Jeffrey Epstein stole countless millions of dollars from him, pocketed that money himself through Epstein's work as Wexner's power of attorney and so forth. But Ghislaine is, to me, the fascinating story because, and I do think that, the government wanted to try Jeffrey Epstein. He died under mysterious circumstances in his cell. I have to say there's a lot of people who believe that he was silenced, that some assassin was able to enter his cell and kill him. I actually, with an investigative reporter here in New York, who was a deep true crime investigator for a number of years for the New York Post, the investigation for my book shows that Epstein took his own life, despite the grandiose stories that he was snuffed out. I do believe that he took his own life. And the reason being is because this was a guy who was an absolute control freak. The temperature in his bedroom had to be set at 55 degrees. He had to have a certain number of towels presented to him after his massages. His workers couldn't look him in the eye. The women had to address him in a certain way. When he was arrested and put into a jail cell, I believe he fully cracked because this was a man for the first time in his life who didn't have any control. And I think that in this, new Me Too generation that we're in, where they have gone after the Bill Cosbys and the Harvey Weinsteins, that Epstein saw the writing on the wall, and that was he was going to spend the rest of his life behind bars. He wasn't going to get the slap on the wrist conviction that happened in 2008 in a Florida case when he was brought to justice down there.
And all this came out of the Miami Herald and journalistic reporting, correct? I'm right in that, right?
Well, Epstein got past this 2008 case. It was a slap on the wrist. He pleaded to a prostitution charge. spent upwards of a year in and out of jail in Florida on a work release program. And then basically it was life as usual. He, however, was going overseas to get the girls as opposed to getting the girls in America because he was being, you know, watched to some degree. But then the Miami Herald did a series on him. And that, again, that opened the public sentiment that, hey, this guy has to go down. And that was when he was arrested. Now, Ghislaine, his, his partner, to me is even more diabolical because she was the major domo of his household. She ran things. In addition, they were intimately involved. However, she took part in the grooming of these young girls. She told them how to dress. She told them how to perform sex acts. And they targeted a lot of women, a lot of young girls, on the belief that Epstein was going to help mentor them, that he was going to get them in arts programs and get them help them through college and so forth. And she was the kind of the mother figure in this. And that when these girls, when they were able to get these girls in their clutches, she came across as kind of this loving, caring type of character.
And was there ever a circumstance where she wasn't involved? My understanding is this all happened with her. So there was no other way. She was the...
Well, she was the conduit to recruiting these girls.
Right.
I mean, she would pluck them in various places. Sometimes she would even go hang around, public schools in New York or Florida and size up a girl and then, you know, literally approach them. She also, the way the sex trafficking ring worked is that the girls who were brought in for the massages who were paid $100 or $200 were then asked to go solicit their own friends. And so, you know, those girls would bring other girls and say, hey, here's a way you can make a couple $100. And so it fed off of each girl fed off of one another. And some girls brought in upwards of 20 or 40 of their friends. So there was this never ending supply of young women coming under their clutches. But, you know, from a perspective, she should have been, she was the kind of that person who could have protected these girls. But instead, out of this warped type of love that she had for Jeffrey Epstein, basically not only looked the other way, but actually took part in the grooming. And I want to read a quote from my book that I think is highly significant in terms of understanding her.
Well, let me just reset. Barry Levine is our guest. He is a journalist from the 1980s. I worked with at the News America many, many years ago. He's done a lot of different things. There's currently a book on Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell called The Spider. Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah. This is a quote that we unearthed for the book, and this was in 1997. And Maxwell, Ghislaine had invited her old friend Christina Oxenberg to celebrate the success of Oxenberg's book. At some point in the meeting, their conversation turned to Ghislaine's relationship with Epstein. And this is how Oxenberg, who is a journalist and a writer, quoted Ghislaine as saying, she said, quote, "Jeffrey is very important to me and I need to marry him." But she confided to Oxenberg that she was unable to keep up with Epstein's quote unquote sexual appetite because Epstein's needs, she said, were impossible to meet. Ghislaine said she felt obliged to, quote, "bring him young girls to fulfill his sexual needs." Oxenberg said she was horrified by what Ghislaine was telling her and tried to change the subject. And then Ghislaine went on and this is a direct quote from her, "They're nothing, these girls. They are trash." And to me, that quote is significant, because you have to think, as a woman, and you're allowing other girls, young girls, younger than you, to be groomed for sexual abuse, that I think that Ghislaine, in this quote, says it all. By calling these girls trash, that they're nothing to her, she was able in her mind to, and this is some dime store psychology on my part, but I believe that she was able in her mind to justify what she was doing out of her commitment to Jeffrey Epstein, in a sense of not seeing these girls as kind of human beings, that they were just vehicles to her end in terms of just bringing them in. Because if someone truly had a moral compass, an emotional center, they could not have done what she had done for so long. And I think that you're going to see that this unravel in this trial. This trial, by the way, is expected to last 6 weeks. As I said, she faces 80 years behind bars. It's attracted attention from media all over the world coming to New York to cover this trial. I think it'll be the biggest, probably it could become the biggest true crime trial possibly since the trial of O.J. Simpson.
Well, I would say the other part of it, the salacious part of all the sex and all the control and all the money, that it does lead down both sides of a political spectrum where the Clintons and the Trumps were all sort of involved. And, you know, I said Tom McMillan, I mean, you go through Jeffrey Epstein, how many people he was ever pictured with. It's a little bit of a who's who of New York socialites. And I know you lived in that world and chased that world around, and celebrities and Hollywood types. I mean, just down the list, there's a lot of people that rubbed up against this in some way, that it's disgusting to everyone, right? But it's also part of, I think, post Cosby, Matt Lauer, I know you've written about Trump's predatorial, that we're just in a different era here as far as, and I think the young athletes, and I still cover them, they understand that, you know, the phone is sort of like, you know, this will capture everything right on down to, you know, an NFL guy committing a murder and locating himself at the scene of the murder. You know what I mean? Like, just how trackable we all are, that this is an era of this dark period of time over the 20 years leading up to the internet, that we'll look back on this and say, this will never be, because of Big Brother watching, this would be a very difficult thing to pull off in the future for any of these, you know, power criminals and, you know, quite frankly, you know, mindfucker people, you know what I mean? The power trip people who have abused women and people and employees and all sorts of people.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that this could never happen in today's society, but it was only very recently that we were living in this world where you know, where girls couldn't pull out a phone and shoot video. What's interesting, and this I'm sure will come up at trial, is that the belief is that Jeffrey Epstein had his home's secret cameras, secret recording devices. And I'm sure Maxwell's going to be asked about that, because, as you brought up, one of the reasons why this story is so salacious and of international interest is because of Jeffrey Epstein's association with Bill Clinton, with Donald Trump, with Bill Gates, with Les Wexner, and big power players. There's former Israeli prime ministers involved in this, you know, in this case. There's famous attorneys.
Well, that's why it turned into a real life clue when he's dead in a cell, because there'll be a lot of people with, you know, some ancillary reason to to hide it. And yeah. there's also a thought that he would never hurt himself because he was too vain to do that, right? So there's always that. And there's always the how do you let a guy kill himself who's on watch? Like, how do we have cells where the most famous guy in the world is under surveillance and winds up dead?
Well, as I said, we devoted months and months of reporting into, you know, what happened and in the cell, and it would have to have been for an assassin to get in there. It would have to have been a conspiracy of just vast of a vast level. Bill Barr, the at the time. He said this, you know, the quote was something like, this was the perfect storm. I mean, you had
Bill Barr has been a liar from the beginning. So I don't care who killed, Epstein at this point, but I'm fascinated by the trial in your book and just the details that go into this, because it is such a, so you talk to a lot of victims in this.
Yes,
people.
Yes, we did. We interviewed a lot of survivors for the book. And there was one survivor, a woman named Haley Robson, that had never given a an interview before. And I had read that she had once worked for her high school newspaper, and that, you know, appealed to me. And I gave her an opportunity to write a chapter at the end of my book. And I worked with her through that, you know, writing, and it was some therapy to some degree for her to be able to put into words what happened. And now, you know, I can say I'm very proud of her because she's going around the country now speaking out about sexual abuse. So I feel even in the writing of my book that, you know, at least one victim was helped to some degree by doing something in a positive fashion that has helped them move forward. And I hope the book certainly will help others. I think that the key things that the public will be looking for at this trial is whether or not Maxwell is forced to give up any names, is to reveal what the true story was behind Jeffrey Epstein and Prince Andrew. Of course, Prince Andrew is being sued civilly by one of the victims right now in New York for abuse of this a woman underage. He's not facing any criminal charges, but of course, his involvement in the case is one of the reasons why the British press is so focused on what's happening here. So, you know, the question will be whether or not at the end of the day, she does any type of a deal in terms of giving up information about rich and powerful individuals who were caught.
Well, she's going to jail for a long time. She's not coming out of jail, right?
Well, I think in the society that we're living in right now, and I also think she comes across as a very elitist, unlikable person, a very cold, chilling and calculated woman, that she is not going to gain any favor with the jurors. But I think that there was possibly an opportunity initially after her arrest. And again, she's denied everything. She's denied, you know, the grooming of these girls. She's denied taking part in any type of sexual abuse. She said that in past civil depositions. So part of the trial will be on whether or not she lied in her depositions. But I do think that if she were to fall on the sword and give up true detail about some of these other very wealthy, rich and powerful men in Jeffrey Epstein's orbit, that it is possible that the government, would reduce the number of years that she's going to serve behind bars. And at one point, there was an indication that she could, if she were to give up names, she could get, you know, 10 years behind bars, which, you know, for her at age 59 is the difference with having a life after jail and not having a life. But for the most part, she's been defiant. She has tried to get out on bail a number of times. The government won't let her out because they say she's a flight risk. And I truly believe she absolutely is. There are individuals that she knows that have the means to spirit her out on a, you know, on a boat in the middle of the night or a private plane to a country that doesn't have extradition with the United States. So they're watching her. They want to bring her to trial. What happened to Epstein was an absolute, you know, black eye for the justice system, and they're intent on, you know, bringing her in shackles before a jury. So, you know, they got a couple of weeks to go.
Barry Levine has been a friend for a long, long time, going on 4 decades. We were once sports writers together at the Baltimore News American. He has been climbing hills and mountains and doing things. You said something about celebrity tabloids an hour ago when we began this conversation in that direction. And the book is The Spider on Ghislaine Maxwell and, of course, Jeffrey Epstein. I hope you sell a lot of books. I would have had you on the Trump book, and we could certainly circle back on that the next time we come together and even discuss the legend of Buddy Ryan, who I later did a television show with, who you covered. So
Buddy was a crusty old character.
Buddy loved me. So you know what I mean? I could see what it was like to be a player for Buddy, that if he loved you, you'd run through a wall for him. So I was that guy with Buddy. And then Rex and Rob and all them. Rob's still hanging around here trying to run up the Ravens linebackers. Hey, dude, a pleasure. And really good to see you. Always good to see old friends that I began my career with. And I'm glad you're alive and doing well and writing books and doing good things.
Thank you. You
working on anything else? Yeah, that book's in your hands. You got to be working on the next book, right?
I'm working on two others right now. One's a true crime, and the other is another book that I'm still investigating and researching. So I'm keeping myself busy. But if you have to look back at a time in your career that really was full of amazing camaraderie, great writing, nights out on the town, and sitting with a bunch of great reporters and listening to Nancy Sinatra singing "These Boots Are Made for Walking." It was nothing better than those days that we all relish now from our old Baltimore News American days.
Barry, I sell my soul for some Burke's onion rings, world famous, in a box right now with some ketchup and an ice cold Michelob goblet. One of the look like a chalice of ice that we would drink out of from the tap. Barry Levine, you can find his book, The Spider, and find him out. Just put Amazon, Barry Levine books, stuff pops up.
Go buy him
and check him out. Barry, we'll see you in New York sometime soon, brother.
Thank you, Nestor, and happy holidays to you.
Man, I'm glad we're all still here, 37, 38 years later. Look at that, Barry Levine. Hey, we are doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. It's all presented by the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play. We're going to be playing with our mayor, Brandon Scott, at Coco's. It's been about 6 months coming. Been about 20 years coming for me to get a crab cake at Coco's. I'm looking forward to that. And a mutual friend of Barry Levine and I, Mike Rosigliano, will be joining us, as is Senator Corey McCray, and also some representatives from Coppin State, our flagship, as well as basketball season has now begun. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and for 30 years, we've been doing it Baltimore Positive style.